Hello and welcome to The Third Degree, the second show for this year. If you have heard our show before, that's not usually our theme music, we're aware of that. I'm Nick and I'm in with Libby this morning.
Hello, yes, and we've got some interesting things coming up on the show today. We're going to be talking to Anthony Lowenstein about the resource wars happening across the world. But right now, some new news that's happening in Tasmania. Things are heating up there again with the pulp mill making headlines. Earlier this week, Environment Minister Peter Garrett confused us all a little bit when he announced that Guns Limited pulp mill had failed to win approval from the government as it needed to meet 3 marine impact requirements. However, later it was confirmed that the pulp mill can actually begin construction now as the construction works were approved after environmental assessment. 13 of the 16 conditions being assessed were approved by Mr. Garrett, and Guns now has a 2-year extension until March 2011 to satisfy the marine effluent impact requirements. And this probably isn't going to be too hard for Guns, as they actually designed these requirements themselves. Meanwhile, Guns has just served another writ on 13 more activists for an action that occurred at the Tryabunna woodchip mill in December last year. I spoke with Ulla Majeski, who's one of the activists who's been served a writ by Guns, and also Paul Oosting, who has been campaigning against the pulp mill with the Wilderness Society.
Last month, a number of peaceful forest defenders shut down Guns Limited's Tryabunna mill to highlight the ongoing destruction of Tasmania's ancient carbon-dense forests, and also to speak out against the Labor Party's pitiable and pitiful cuts, which were announced as part of the white paper.
Ulla Majeski is a Tasmanian forests campaigner and spokesperson for Still Wild, Still Threatened. She is one of the 13 activists who has been served a writ by Guns Limited, who is claiming damage for trespass and seeking an injunction to prevent defendants from entering its property.
I would say it's probably not wholly unexpected, but it is completely outrageous that peaceful forest defenders are being targeted in this manner. I mean, it's just highlighting the fact that Guns Limited has continued over a number of years to target peaceful environmentalists and activists who are speaking out against the continued decimation of Tasmania's old growth and high conservation value forests.
This comes just days after Federal Environment Minister Peter Garrett announced there were just 3 marine impact requirements left that had to be met before the pulp mill could begin operations.
Well, Peter Garrett has given Guns approval for 13 of 16 modules which he was assessing, and for the remaining 3 modules, he's given Guns a further 2 years to try and attempt to complete the work. Those 3 modules relate to the impact that dumping 64,000 tonnes of toxic pollution into Bass Strait per day would have on marine life and Tasmania's fishing industry. So essentially, Peter Garrett has given Guns the go-ahead to begin construction before critical scientific work has been complete.
Paul Oosting has been campaigning against the pulp mill with the Wilderness Society. He is concerned that Garrett's announcement has given the green light to the construction of the mill.
Certainly Peter Garrett has tried to put a spin on it. What has happened is that the Federal Labor Government have failed in their environmental credentials. They have given Guns the go-ahead to begin constructing the pulp mill and given them a 2-year extension to try and prove that the mill won't have a negative impact on the marine environment. That comes after 4 years of an assessment process, when in fact Peter Garrett should have been saying to Guns Limited that enough is enough, you haven't been able to meet the conditions, you can't build the pulp mill.
Community members are concerned that the pulp mill will cause other environmental damage apart from marine impact.
When Guns pulled out of the independent assessment 2 years ago, many of the mill's major impacts have been ignored by both state and federal governments as they established truncated and fast-track assessments to try and get this project approved. So far, nobody has looked at the impact the project would have on Tasmania's native forests, our wildlife, water catchments, and also on climate change, because Guns' project is reliant on large-scale destruction of Tasmania's native forests, which are huge stores of greenhouse gases, and those gases are released in the atmosphere when logging occurs.
All Tasmanians are quite outraged by what's going on and will continue to take a stand against Guns' destructive logging and wood chipping practices.
There are also concerns that if Guns begins construction on the mill, they might refuse to halt operations if research shows that it will have a negative impact on the marine environment.
Once construction begins, it will take almost 2 years to build the pulp mill. What we're concerned about is a situation where Gunns begins constructing the mill even though critical scientific work hasn't been completed, and then refuses, for instance, to abide by the federal government's decision or the changes to the project, or for that matter, a complete refusal to the project if the scientific work comes back negative. We don't want to see a situation where Gunns begins constructing their mill and then is able to hold the government to ransom by saying, we can't stop building the mill, otherwise people will, in construction, won't be employed and we'll lose the money we've already invested, so you have to allow us to build the project as we've decided to do.
This is not the first time that Gunns has taken legal action against protesters. In 2005, they served a writ against 20 individuals and groups. This court case continues, though a number of defendants have been dropped. The Gunns 20 writ was served just 2 days before Gunns Limited launched their pulp mill proposal, with Gunns chairman John Gay now saying that the company could begin construction on the mill, though they are still seeking more financial support. This new writ could be interpreted as an attempt to discourage activists against further action.
I can't really speculate as to what's going on in John Gay's head, but it certainly is very interesting timing considering Peter Garrett's recent pulp mill announcement. But I think that many Tasmanians and many people across the Australian mainland will not be deterred by outrageous legal actions such as this and will continue to speak out and stand up against Gunns' proposed pulp mill.
Oh, and that was Ulla Majeski, who's been served a writ by Gunns and is spokesperson for Still Wild, Still Threatened. But right now, we're joined on the line with Anthony Lowenstein, who's a journalist and a bit of a Middle East expert. Hi, Anthony, are you there?
I am. Thanks for having me.
Ah, excellent. Now, you've been writing about resource wars at recently, and I thought it might be interesting. You start one of your articles on resource wars by referring to an article that was written by Richard A. Clarke, who described his vision of America in 2011, in which he predicted that world oil prices would spike to $81 a barrel before falling back to $72, which seems a little bit naive or something now. Could you maybe paint your own picture of how you imagine the next 10 years might look in terms of energy resources and the response of world powers to shortages?
Of course, it's obviously very, very difficult to predict these things, but clearly what's happening at the moment is, and I think the Iraq war was probably the first case of a 21st century resource war, but the Iraq war, I think, was fought for a number of different reasons, but clearly access to oil was a big part of that. I think also support for Israel was a part of it, amongst other things. And the reality is that Iraq has the second highest amount of oil in the world after Saudi Arabia. So it's a pretty rich prize, and at the moment you could argue that what the US has done there, despite the massive amounts of destruction and violence, has actually been a success from their point of view. I'm not saying from the human point of view, but from their point of view, Iraq has allegedly up to $30 to $40 billion US worth of oil. The Iraq war itself has obviously cost a great deal more than that, but the reality is that a great deal of Western multinational oil companies have access now to that kind of oil in the next coming years. So from their perspective, you could say that the price has been worth it. I think what we're also seeing in the next years is a reordering of the Middle East power balance. You've seen even in the current times with the war in Israel's war against Gaza, that the Arab powers that are supported by the US, principally Jordan, Egypt and Saudi Arabia, are basically siding with the US and Israel against Hamas because Hamas is backed by Iran. And the splintering, I think, of those kind of relationships is where things are going to continue to move. And the way that relates to resource wars, of course, is that Saudi Arabia is the biggest supplier of oil to the West and indeed to the world, and is run by a fundamentalist state. I spent time there in 2007, and it's certainly a very interesting place where, you know, women can't drive, they can't work. Essentially, it is a dictatorship. There's no other word for that. Of course, the Middle East is only one part of that picture, and in my essay, without wishing to go into great detail, I also look at other issues in Latin America and Africa too. And I think we're even seeing now, a lot of people have argued that the conflict in Darfur, not that it's only about resources, it's not, but resources is certainly one reason amongst many why that genocide is happening.
And I guess that's the thing, isn't it? A lot of these issues are all very connected up. You also quote Lawrence Solomon, who writes that there's still a lot more oil exploration to be done in Africa, Asia, South America, and even the oceans, as well as other resources such as coal. Mm-hmm. How common is this point of view, and what will it take to, I guess, make the argument for renewables, which is sort of seems to be a last resort for a lot of people in the mainstream?
Well, Lawrence Solomon, I don't know a great deal about him personally, but he's certainly a very conservative writer in the States, and his point in the conservative journal, I think it was in 2007 or 8, I can't remember the exact year, was basically saying, all these people are complaining about dwindling resources, they're deluded, the world is full of resources, we just need to dig underground in the oceans or elsewhere, we're never going to run out of them. Now, in some ways it's difficult to respond to that rationally, because no one particularly knows. There may well be a great deal of resources or riches under the ocean, we don't really know. But the point really is exactly that his implication is that the West has the right and the influence and the ability to exploit any resources or any peoples, for that matter, in its pursuit of energy. So, and that, of course, what we see consistently. I mean, the only reason, principal reason why, for example, the West has a very close relationship with Saudi Arabia is because they have the oil. It's not because they're particularly, and the regime is willing to make a deal with the West to give that oil over for a decent amount of money. The issue, I think, of renewables is a key one. But in much of the debate, certainly in the last 8 years during the Bush administration, that debate's been pretty, below the surface. Mm-hmm. President-elect Obama has talked about changing that dynamic, changing that debate, and some of the people who he's put in place in his environmental policy area apparently have spoken out forcefully for renewables. So the question very much is, I guess we're going to have to wait and see. It seems likely that I think America's position on this will shift. And indeed, it needs to shift because, A, for environmental reasons, it needs to shift, but also to get other countries on board. When America kind of lags behind, I mean, we saw this during the Howard years in Australia, that John Howard was able to say, well, America's not acting, so why should we? I mean, that's basically the argument. If Obama, for example, makes serious moves to cut greenhouse gases or, for that matter, to invest in renewables, I think it's quite likely that some like Kevin Rudd and others will follow suit, despite, I might add, the appallingly low targets he set for the ETS.
So, the incoming Obama administration, Obama had been saying for quite a while that he wanted to invade Pakistan. Indeed, you know, the US started making incursions into Pakistan a little while ago now. How do you see a prospective, invasion or whatever kind of action in Pakistan fitting into this sort of view of the resource wars?
I think the issue of Pakistan is a fascinating one, and Obama certainly made comments during the campaign where he seemed to suggest that if Pakistan or somebody wasn't appropriately looking for certain so-called terrorists, that America would bomb Pakistan. He wasn't talking so much about a ground invasion, not that that made it okay, but I think the problem with Pakistan, of course, is a few-fold. Firstly, you have a situation where most of the governments in Pakistan for a number of years essentially walked two sides of the fence. On the one hand, during the Musharraf era, which is basically during the Bush years, he received $10 billion of aid to supposedly root out terrorism. In fact, a great deal of that money went to the ISI, who's this sort of very shady intelligence service within the country. And many of those people are sympathetic to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in the first place. So that's one problem. The second problem is that there's virtually no public support for the current leadership, Zardari, who's an incredibly corrupt man, who's the husband of assassinated former leader Benazir Bhutto. Mm. In relation to the resource issues, of course, some people have argued that because America is so has so many problems in Afghanistan, that's not going to change anytime soon. Pakistan is obviously a key country in that war, and I'm someone, for example, who desperately opposes the idea of increasing troops to Afghanistan, but I think the reality is Obama will increase troops. Mm. There's talk about 30,000, if not more. Australia has said they won't send more troops. I suspect when Obama gets in and he makes the call to Kevin Rudd and says, hey, send me some more, I suspect, sadly, Australia will. Of course, it's important to remember, though, that a recent study about 3-4 months ago found that the majority of Australians were opposed to the war in Afghanistan. Reading most of the newspapers across the board, from the so-called Fairfax Press to The Australian, you get a sense that the Australian public supports this war. In fact, they don't. They're against the war. Mm. But the argument, of course, is made that it's a fight against terrorism, etc., which is a nonsense war. The reality is most Afghani people don't want us to be there. The Pakistan influence clearly is important because Pakistan used to support the Taliban, and many elements within Afghanistan, Pakistan still supports. There's no doubt that there are, if we talk about a cliche, this term, terror central, so to speak, there's no doubt Pakistan has profound problems in terms of supporting terrorism and backing terrorists who are vehemently opposed to the West. Of course, one thing which we regularly in the West forget is that every time America drops bombs on villages or wedding parties in Afghanistan, which happens amazingly often,
yeah,
you are creating incredible anger towards the West. And individuals in Pakistan who support that, I mean, a lot of people have argued that much of the Al-Qaeda leadership is now based in Pakistan. We don't really know the truth of that, but Pakistan's key, obviously, in this equation.
Sure. You also made note in your article that Israel's occupation in Palestine serves as a blueprint for prospective US actions in the Middle East and indeed how they've conducted the war in Iraq. In light of this, how do you... What's your view on, you know, what's going on in Gaza at the moment?
Well, the situation in Gaza obviously is shocking beyond belief, although on one level quite unsurprising. The reality is that since Hamas won a free and fair election in 2006, an election, I might add, that was initially supported by the US, ironically, before, of course, they realised that the wrong party had won that election. And the reason why Hamas won wasn't because every single Palestinian was interested in some kind of fundamentalist Islam to live under. They did it because Fatah, the previous people in power under Arafat, were corrupt. And Hamas was seen as being relatively clean and providing a great deal of social services for the people. What's happening in Gaza at the moment is undoubtedly a war against the Palestinian people. Whatever you hear in the media about a sort of struggle against Islamic terrorism or rockets has nothing to do with that. Of course, the rockets that are being fired from Gaza into Israel have to stop, and they're a crime. There's no doubt about that. And I've written about that extensively. But the reality is, in the last year and a half, since Hamas has won power, 2 years in fact now, the West, led by the US, has imposed an incredibly tight blockade on the Palestinian people, essentially in an attempt to try and force them to overthrow Hamas, which has not succeeded. And the reality now, you have an incredibly bizarre situation, which is brutal beyond belief, where a handful of Israelis have been killed in the last year from rockets. But now you have close to 700 dead Palestinians, the vast majority of whom are civilians. And the question really is, what is this supposed to achieve? Israel claims, and the US and indeed Australia claims, is to root out terrorism and to stop the rockets. But the problem is that if Israel, which it appears wants to do, to destroy Hamas or destroy its ability to govern, what happens then? I mean, Hamas won an election by the majority of the Palestinian people. We seem to want to ignore that fact. Secondly, Israel, as far as we can tell, has no actual desire to reoccupy Gaza because, frankly, that takes massive expense and manpower. So what happens next? It's actually difficult to know what happens. My fear, and this has been talked about in some of the Israeli press, is that Israel actually has a desire to try and impose a compliant leadership, like Fatah, who are now based in the West Bank. The problem with that is that increasingly Fatah, led by Mahmoud Abbas, has been engaged with Israel in so-called negotiations for 2 years and come up with absolutely nothing. There's been no achievement. It's been talks. This is one of the great myths of this conflict. This is what I talk about in my book, that we're constantly fed this line that there's a peace process. It's nonsense. It's a sense of a peace process. In other words, it's talk for the sake of talk. While there is talk going on between Israel and the Palestinians, although not so much at the moment, the reality is the occupation in the West Bank is increasing in size. And one of the real challenges for the incoming Obama administration, which I can't sound that optimistic about, is to actually, for the first time in history, put serious pressure on Israel to say, unless you stop settlement building, unless you ease restrictions on Palestinians, our support for you will decrease. Now, it's hard to imagine that happening, frankly.
Absolutely.
And the reason I mentioned in the essay about the model that before the Iraq War, the Americans often were speaking to the Israelis to get advice how to manage a indigenous population. Now, there's no doubt, I think, that the insurgency in Iraq did come as a surprise to the Americans, believe it or not, and you can read this just by hearing comments by senior Bush administration officials. Amazingly enough, they did not actually expect much of resistance. They thought they were going to literally ride in on horseback, so to speak, and be greeted as liberators. They actually believed that because they're profoundly deluded and ignorant about history, and people, particularly in the outer world, don't like to be occupied. So, unfortunately, Israel has become, as you said before, a blueprint for how to try and manage an occupation. Keep in mind the fact that despite the massive cost that the occupation in Iraq is costing, and for that matter in the West Bank by Israel, it's regarded as somehow sustainable. In other words, yes, it's expensive, yes, it's violent, yes, people are being killed, but in some ways you have control over certain resources and certain people, and therefore it's seen as worthwhile in keeping it on.
And on that, on the Iraq War, and I guess having control of resources, do you think this growing tendency to exploit people, so for resources and for other things, that this is just going to get worse and worse as world resources get smaller and smaller?
Well, I wish I could say the answer was no to that question. I think the answer is clearly yes, isn't it? I mean, the evidence is so overwhelming for it. The Middle East is only but one area of that. And, of course, one of the things that has been made, just to shift areas for a minute, is the war in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which doesn't get much press in the West, but it is one of the most brutal conflicts in the last 60 years. Over, I think, 4 to 5 million people have been killed over the last 25 years. It's an incredibly brutal conflict, basically out of our media, because a cynic in me says because it's black people and the media doesn't like to talk about black people that much, sadly. But the reality is that in that country, a lot of the companies and who are many Western multinationals, and for that matter other countries in the region, are exploiting that land for resources, particularly certain minerals, which are very profitable. One of the key things, I don't touch on this in the essay, but I should have probably, is water. Water is an undoubtedly dwindling resource. Oil, of course, is a separate issue. Oil is a profound issue too, but water actually, arguably, you could say, is even more necessary for life than oil, or equally so, anyway.
Possibly.
Indeed. And in many parts of the world, not least Africa, there's a serious water shortage, and you've already seen in certain parts of that continent certain conflicts over that issue. Again, going back to Israel-Palestine, there are profound issues in that conflict about water issues. The Middle East is not particularly wet, and much of the negotiation between Israel and Palestine over the years is about how the water is going to be divided. I mean, it's quite surreal to travel across the West Bank, as I did a few years ago, and you see these incredibly lush Jewish settlements, which have sort of sprinklers on, watering their lovely gardens, while literally 100 metres down the road, literally across a massive fence guarded by the Israeli army, you have a Palestinian farm that can't get access to water. It's as simple as that. And the reality behind that is that Israel has built such an incredibly successful infrastructure where the settlements are kind of tended and watered, literally and figuratively, and the Palestinians have no access to water at all. It's a real problem, and that sort of thing is only going to get worse, sadly. I'm not being very optimistic, and I apologise for that, but at the moment, I guess the situation in Gaza, say, is so overwhelmingly bad, it's just impossible to see how anything good can come out of it.
Yeah, and no, all the I guess those sorts of attitude to resources really doesn't bode well for the environment and climate change generally.
No.
But that's probably about all we have time for, Anthony. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Pleasure. Thank you so much for giving me the time. I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, not at all. Thanks for coming on.
Pleasure.
Okay. So that was Anthony Lowenstein, just talking about the resource wars there. And we've got a little bit of music for you now. What are we playing, Nick?
Well, this is kind of a special one. This is coming off the new Animal Collective album. This is Brother Spoiled. If you hadn't heard Animal Collective before, they're a strange little experimental outfit coming from New York and Portugal and Paris and wherever the hell the four members live at this point. This is Brother Spoiled.
Open up your, open up your, open up your throat and let the all of that time, all of that time, all of that time go. I know it sucks to daddy's door, but try to think of what you want. You got to open up your, open up your, open up your throat. Hey!
We hope you're enjoying this one, and we are going to play the rest of it. We'll see you next week on The Third Degree.
Yeah. Have a great week.